This is a production of Cornell University.
It's 4:46 p.m. and I'm going to call this meeting to order. Peter, when you're ready, can you please call the roll? Here. Does anybody have extra agendas? There are a lot of members that don't have agendas.
I have a few.
If you need an agenda, raise your hand. All right. Just a reminder that we don't have microphones in here, so for members especially, make sure to limit or have no side conversation because it's going to be very hard to hear in here. Julia, are you in?
So if you could all, like, take a moment to shut down your laptops, put away your phones. We're going to begin our moment of silence to remember Angel Hierro, a Cal student in the class of 2017, and a friend to many people, both on the assembly and around campus. Angel was a student leader in Mosaic Haven and the Latino Living Center. He was a predominant voice for the entire Latinx community and an incredible human being with the most wonderful sense of humor and vibrant personality. My last interaction that wasn't in passing with Angel was when we took our senior pictures together, and we both talked about how ready we were to graduate, but how also Cornell impacted us and how we couldn't wait for our moms to have our pictures. Angel will always be remembered for being a fun-loving person, for being an advocate for his community, and for always keeping members of this assembly in check. Angel is a meaningful person to me, and I hope we can take this moment to reflect upon how his life has impacted so many on our campus and how we can continue to live like Angel and uphold his legacy. Thank you so much, everyone. If you'd like to hear more about resources, we'd be happy to share them. We've also shared them on the assembly page, and also we are looking toward contributing to Angel's family, so if you'd like to hear more about that, please reach out to me personally.
Thank you, Julia.
inflation. That's the slope after it's been inflation adjusted. So there is a potential squeeze on individuals that are unaided, but at the lower income, particularly at the lower income of the unaided class. And that's one of the issues that I asked the financial aid committee to look at, to think about that squeeze, to think about fairness across all income cohorts, to think about what we needed to do, if anything, to address that. Sorry. I do want to make another point, and that is that Cornell actually, relative to our Ivy peers, has the lowest percentage of students from the top income, top 1% of income, and in the bottom 60%, we have almost the highest percentage. So we, relative to our Ivy peers again, we do relatively well in terms of trying to spread the Cornell education as much as we can. Now we have a long way to go for this. This is the percentage of students from income classes at Cornell. The lowest 20% of income represent 5% of our Cornell cohort. And you see how the income, the percentage of students increases as the income increases. So that lowest 20% is 20% of the income of family incomes of the United States, and we have 5% of those people represented in Cornell. So we have a ways to go here, despite the fact of the previous slide that we're spreading this perhaps better, if you will, than our Ivy peers. So the two main things I asked the financial aid working group to do were, one, examine fairness. I mentioned this idea of this squeeze of individuals that are not financially aided. Our calculation indicates that their family contribution and loans and income expectations of the student should be able to meet the full cost of education at Cornell. So we provide no grant aid. That group and the groups that are whose loans are highest at the upper income groups are groups that we ask to look at in terms of perhaps spreading our financial aid in a different way, if that were justified. This was a committee of students, several people in this room have been on the committee, faculty, deans, and other administration. The second thing we asked them to look at was what would be options that we could think about were there to be another financial aid, another financial downturn, and were we need to adjust this? What are the levers that we could potentially pull to allow us to continue to support those students with the most need? So I'll give you a general category of the general ideas that the committee has come back with. Yesterday or the day before, Dean Newt sent me the updated recommendations with degree of support by the committee. And just in general, these are thinking about the loan amounts. Some of these suggestions are increasing the loan amount for certain income classes. Others are decreasing the loan amounts for certain income classes. Second, do we need to look at changing the income bracket? Spreading this a little bit, changing where we sort of break our financial aid policy and where our loans, for example, break. Third, parent contribution expectations. Are there areas in which we can say the parent contributions are not appropriate or are not as consistent as in other areas? And then fourth is the international makeup of students. impact, for example, for a financial spread turned down like we saw in 2008. These are all recommendations. They haven't been adopted. They're just ideas that have been put forward by the committee. They have certain degrees of recommendations for some of them and non-recommendations for others. Some of the ideas have been taken off the list entirely. And the next step, so no decisions have been made yet. We're going to talk about, we're going to continue to have discussions. I want to get feedback from students today. And I'm going to get feedback from trustees in the March meeting. And then we'll have further discussions with faculty and students before we decide whether we make any changes. So the options are we make no changes, we make slight changes, or we make significant changes, and that'll be after a full discussion of the recommendations. Now, I don't have the specific recommendations for you now to comment on. I hope to be able to give you more information and come back and to get comments. But I would like, I do think it's appropriate now to open this up and talk a little bit about what you're thinking about this process. And I see that Dean Newton is here and she can answer any of our questions.
We'll start with Allison if anybody wants to be on the speaker's list from the community office.
Hi.
Go ahead.
All right.
Make it comfortable.
Yeah. Do you want to move?
Sure.
Yeah. I guess I'll go ahead and get started. Thank you so much for coming to speak with us today about this issue. This is certainly something that concerns me personally as a transfer student. I was concerned with that aspect, but I'm glad not to be on that board today. Something that I want to mention, and you may correct me, anyone may correct me if I'm wrong, but back in 2008, when the university faced financial recession and some of the economic situation in our country, President Torrey came out and still urged trustees and urged the administration to increase financial aid. It troubled me, concerns me personally, that the university is facing financial aid now, and the first place they're looking to financial aid when President Torrey, back when he was in office, he highlighted and supported financial aid in a time like 2008, which I would presume would have better state now than it was then. I would also like to add my concerns with the international student makeup, and that is, from what I'm understanding of this proposal, is that you want to increase the number of non-aid financial aid students in order to reduce the amount of need and initiate cost savings for financial aid. And that would concern me because then it's disproportionately affecting low-income international student applicants. And when Dean Newton came last year to speak to the assembly, my understanding was that this policy was being instituted to support international students, not affect international student applicants.
So let me correct a few. You made a few statements that are I have to correct. So first of all, you're absolutely correct that President Shorten at the time made a major investment in financial aid at in 2008 following the downturn when we were in significant financial stress. However, I have to also point out that while David was president, we also, a very similar group like I've initiated, also went back and adjusted financial aid and change some of those parameters to make it sustainable. Now, the thing that you stated that's inaccurate is that somehow we're doing this in the first place we're looking for to save money is financial aid. The goal, what I said to the committee was we're not looking to change our investment in financial aid. So I want to make very clear this is not a cost-saving exercise. This is an exercise to look at fairness, and to look at what levers we would have should we need them in the future. That's all. Second, on international aid, we will not, in any, there's no suggestion or no intent at all to decrease the amount of financial aid that we're putting towards international students. I want to be very clear about that. not decreasing our commitment of financial aid to international students. One option in the report, again, an option we may or may not adopt it, is if we have a financial downturn, to dial up the number of international students, not to decrease the financial aid to students that need it, but to dial up the need aware component of this and to take slightly more international students. Whether we adopt that or not, how we would do that is just an idea that was put forward in the proposal, in the draft. So there's the competitive component to it. You mentioned the cost factor. There's also the reality, I think, that students in that income, first-gen students and students at our lowest income cohorts face challenges, often financially supporting others in their family. These points have been made and they've been heard, believe me. So, but I thank you for
next is Chris Scott. My apologies.
Second point, I think, wealth is not necessarily correlated with
all international students applications. And some of our peer institutions have a much greater endowment, and they are need blind all the way through. So they're need blind for international as well as domestic students, for DACA students, undocumented students. Unfortunately, we have to make some choices. What we've done is make choices to fully support those students for whom we have enough financial aid to fully meet needs, so that they're not disadvantaged when they come to Cornell. And the top students, international students, who have needs, have that need fully met. Where we run into a difficult choice, of course, is when you run out of that financial aid. What do we do? If we only accepted international students for whom we had enough money to meet full needs, our international population would go away again. We don't want that to happen either. So we're in a difficult place where we need to make choices. I guess I would just emphasize we're already in that place. To your point, whether we decide to increase international students, if we increase international students without increasing financial aid, and we don't have more money for financial aid, we will by necessity be doing what's listed here. And that's a question we're going to have to consider, and it's a question we're going to have to consider as we increase the student body somewhat. I spoke to SA the last time I was here and talked about the idea of housing all of our sophomores and slightly increasing our freshman intake. If we do that, if we have some more international students, it will by necessity be need aware of international students, because unless we're successful in getting more endowments for international financial it'll increase that cost. I hope that explains it. But I do take your point and your concern about differentially going to that space to try and address financial aid.
Next, we have
Aki.
Thank you for coming. I want to make one comment and then I want to ask a question. So very briefly, if Cornell were to increase international students, which is not required, that would be increasing our diversity to some extent, but it is very important for Cornell to know that a lot of the richer international students have the same experiences. A lot of them will go to school in the U.S., or international school in their own country. So I'm very worried about the fact that the diversity that we have at Cornell might go down if we choose that option. Of course, I can speak on behalf of every international student's experiences, but I don't know about that, and I can speak a little bit about what I've seen from my interactions with international students. And then my question is kind of related. On the recommendation of increasing international students who would require the financial aid, the report mentioned that option, I quote, would be received, I quote, with potentially less negative public perception issues than other options that are more visible. End quote. What makes the committee believe that options related to international students would actually be received with less public perception, and why would the international student option be less visible? I think that's a little bit, that made me feel really not good by reading it, and a lot of international students reached out to me and were like, what's up with Cornell? And I didn't even know what to answer.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I can answer your question. I obviously didn't write that. I don't know what the fully what the thinking was. I do think we have to be very careful about that kind of articulation, and I would not want to see that in a final report. I think it's unfortunate that the report was leaked before issues like that were looked at beyond a draft of committee and really thought about and considered, and we had input. But the other point I want to make is that declare me, you have the same same chances of getting admitted before this as before we move to need aware. I think you made the point to me a year ago or so that, if I'm correct in remembering, you were a person that applied for need, did not get need, still came to Cornell and was able to succeed here.
And not me, but other people.
Okay, so certainly other people were in that class. I just want to make the point that that's still an option at Cornell, and I hope it will be, that if people can acquire the resources either, you know, for family or other areas, that even though their parents' income may not be be able to support the full cost of education at Cornell, we're not closing that off for international students. They can still apply. What we are doing is trying to say, if you absolutely have need and you've been accepted to Cornell without knowing that Cornell cannot provide the funds to meet that need, that's a concern.
So our speaker list is getting really long, but I also want to make sure that community members know that they can be added to the speakers list. But I'm going to ask that we have two members ask a question, and I'll give them only a minute, and then we'll give you a couple of minutes to respond. But I'm going to be strict with a minute speaking time for members because we only have about 15 minutes left. So next we have David.
Can I do a real short answer to that? So I think it's a great point. We are both considering things that improve the situation for the lowest income group at Cornell and offsets to be able to allow us to do that. So these are things that both increase financial aid and increase the amount of spend, the cost of financial aid, if you will. Some of the suggestions are actually increasing our would cost Cornell more. Some are offset. So we're trying to do this in a way to preserve our competitiveness for underrepresented minorities, first-gen students, all of our areas that the 5% in that lowest income bracket, as well as achieving fairness. So I think to your point, I think there are trade-offs here on both sides that we're looking at.
Next we have Nick.
About being able to make sure the context is out. I know that John reached out to everyone.
public attendance at the meeting would help us get to where we need to be. But what I will say is, I very much agree with you that this has got to be a more open process. So what I hope, the way that I conceive of that happening, is there's some information in that report that includes information about other institutions that's confidential information that we're not really allowed to share. What I would like to do is have a digestive report available for everybody who can have it in the Sun. This is what I offered when I found out that a version had been leaked. And that digest would have both the context, would have the those elements of the data that the committee has looked at that that are shareable, and then the recommendations some of the weighting and the committee's recommendations around the weighting. Mark, do you have any concern about that as a process?
Weighing in, and the report will be revised each morning on a weekly basis. Of course,
or when do you feel you'll have a final final recommendation?
It depends what you mean final, Mike. We're discussing a short trustee.
Yeah.
So I assume it's going to be revised. It may be revised after that.
Yeah, no, but I mean, okay. I was thinking in this current cycle of draft documents and.
Well, I have to get it for the board when I was 17 years ago.
Okay.
So there will be another meeting at least by then.
Okay. So we'll have a pretty close to, certainly ready for board evaluation by the 17th.
And Tristan will be on our last question.
Okay. Thanks for coming.
Sure. So we're that was the subject of another presentation to the SA. We're going through a process now where we hope to launch a building project that will provide enough dorm space for every freshman and every sophomore in Cornell. Either dorm space or Greek housing or program housing or West Campus. Between that aggregate, we'll have enough for everyone. And so on the international housing, on the international students, some of that is, I think this slight increase in the classes is class admission is likely at the margin to have some increase in international students, even if we just maintain the same percentage of Cornell now, which is about 9%. That would say that 9% of the 250, 275 new students would be international students.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for a rational, really excellent discussion. I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
There are a couple more questions. Would it be okay if I convey them to you via email?
Absolutely.
Happened the last couple of years, but apparently a few
good alternative for people who didn't like grab an alcohol-filled event, so they can still enjoy a great day. So those two events we're currently seeking funding for. Because our budget, we have about $250,000 funded organization that goes to everything at the event. That's all the tents, all the bathrooms, the volunteer giveaways, as well as security, fences, and leftover money goes toward artist collection. And as I mentioned, we have a smaller budget this year, but we don't have any rollover money. We do get some ticket sales, can't really rely on them because they're only from master students and guests. And those go on sale on March 23rd, about 2 weeks from the announcement. For guests and alumni, there'll be 25 pre-sale, 35 the week of. For grad students and faculty, there'll be 20 pre-sale and 30 the week of. The wristband distribution will be the same as last year. It'll be the Monday, the week of the event. We'll start handing out wristbands across campus, a lot of easy access locations. They don't come off once you put them on, so then you have to remind people. The budget is one of our main considerations when we pick the artists. Another one is like lyrics and offensive lyrics. We want to be sensitive to the whole Cornell community. We rely a lot on staff and student volunteers. So we don't want to obviously offend them or any other concert goers if the whole event would fall apart. Another consideration. Another big consideration is safety and risk. So we want to pick artists that don't encourage high-risk behavior. Soka Soka Day is already with a lot of morning drinking. It's already a very high-risk event, so we don't want artists that make a risky event in the first year. And then probably our biggest consideration is the actual artist availability themselves. Artists are excited to play this event. This year, they're definitely excited, but they don't create their tour schedules around Soka Day. That's just how it works. Yes, and we'll more talk about the artists. We'll get it on.
Hey guys, so I'm just gonna drag this out as long as I know. As you know, we send out a selection survey in the fall, and this year we had nearly 9,000 student responses, which is awesome. So we really got a lot of great feedback about last year's Slope Day, as August mentioned, as well as who people would like to see this year. From that, we consolidated a list of artists that were within our budget and brought that to a forum. We've been doing selections forum. This is our second year doing it. It went very well. This is our first year live streaming it, which and doing a login polling service. And that worked out really well, and it's something we hope to keep doing. But that being said, from there, we started contacting agencies, and as August said, they're not even artists who are in our budget and perfect for Slope Day sometimes are just not available. That being said, we are very happy with the lineup that we have, and we're very happy that we're coming here today not just with our co-headliners, but with our openers as well. So, with that, the openers have worked with Chance the Rapper. The openers have worked with Chance the Rapper, and as of a couple weeks ago, because of that work with him, have a couple of Grammys to their name for their work specifically on his track No Problem. They've also been featured on Anderson .Paak's Am I Wrong, and their name is Brass Tracks. So whether you know them by name or not, they're awesome, and we're featuring with them a hip-hop artist named Sinatra, and that's Sinatra with an apostrophe, not an I, who is a great up-and-coming rapper and collaborates with Brass Tracks a lot. And the collaboration between our openers actually is something that'll go on to our first of two co-headliners, that being an awesome EDM and live instrumental group known as Big Gigantic. So that is the first of our co-headliners, and we're very excited about the collaboration that will occur between not only Big Gigantic, but with Brass Tracks and Sinatra as well. They've toured together, they collaborate, they put together really fun, awesome shows that we think will be perfect for the daytime music festival aspect that is Slope Day. And our other co-headliner we think that you'll enjoy and will get you hyped for Slope Day. So, that being said, would you like to hear a song from any of them? Yes. So, opening is Brass Tracks and Sinatra. First co-headliner, Big Gigantic. Second co-headliner, Mr. Wives. All right, so I'll play a little something. This is Big Gigantic. In 20 minutes or so. So, thank you guys for having us. We really think this is going to be a fun Slope Day, and if you have any questions, we open the floor to shoot them.
Does anyone have any questions for Slope Day?
Here. If you want to continue a conversation on funding for the breakfast, please, please, please reach out to anyone on the e-board. We're very, very interested in. And I know you've been talking about it, but like definitely like also after security funding and everything, like on the PR end and like how we can reach out to our constituencies about the breakfast, that way we can make sure everyone's staying on Slope Day.
The number one most recommended artist on the list was, the Chainsmokers, who who, quite frankly, over the last few years have skyrocketed and been in the, you know, having chart toppers back, you know, one after the other. And so they're now, you know, like even 300 plus thousand. So, I mean, from there, we really just look through all of the, you know, the thousands of responses and try to weed out artists. We do the research on each one to find out, you know, what their approximate you know, rate is. And then from there, we consolidate a list, and that's what we presented to the forum. And then from there, we took what people had to say and just and kind of internalized what kind of genres and the vibe that people wanted at Slope Day. And then we started contacting agencies and seeing what deals could be worked out. And this one really worked out. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Both co-headliners were on the list at Forbes.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it starts with 100 names. We'll be like weeding them out. So we get to about 30 at the forum for variety of reasons.
Yeah.
And Vern will be our last question.
I was just wondering if you ever thought about, I know, because it's very open where it's like people put like Beyonce and Fetty Wap and all these like expensive performers,
mm-hmm.
where if you kind of said like, hey, this is like how much money we have and these are the types of artists that we can get, or come up with like a list of the artists that would be available at our price range. And I think that that would be a lot more productive in sort of our decision-making process as a community to say like, oh, these are our options, let's pick from this instead of going like with these fantastical ideas, right?
Right. Yeah, and you know, the history of Slope Day is that we tend to get artists who are, you know, on the rise.
Right.
You know, we had Kendrick right before Pimp the Butterfly. We had Chance right before Surf and Coloring Book. You know, he was still just only on SoundCloud at the time when he came here, and look at him now. So, you know, we pride ourselves in finding artists that are, you know, that are small, but really have potential, and you know, sometimes they end up winning.
We have Kanye West.
Back in like 2004. But yeah, to like answer your point, it, you know, that would be a good idea going forward to specify the amount of money we have, just so people don't shoot over the top.
Yeah.
Totally.
And the live forum does kind of more just that. We have like the 30 names that we actually looked at that are actually kind of more feasible for the budget. I think we did mention the actual price at that forum, and it was live streamed this year. Though that was the first time that happened, and like we had a poll going with a vote on those 30 names. So hopefully next year that'll be a bigger live stream event, and that was exactly what we were talking about. Awesome. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks
for having me.
Guys, there's been a lot of side conversation and everybody's on their phones, and I get that everybody wanted to post for today, but like now we need to get through a lot of things in about 45 minutes, so I'm going to ask that side conversation stop. Dale has a quick announcement.
So if you are here planning to run an election and this is your attendance check-in to attend an SA meeting, Austin McLaughlin, our director of election, has a list. He's going to record your name. So when you get a chance, go up to Austin.
Motion to suspend the agenda and move referendum 32 and 35 next.
Is there any dissent? Seeing no dissent, we'll move on to referendum 32 and 35.
Clause B or Clause 2 in B or on page 4 of 24 of your charter. Oh, I'm sorry. I do have your charter. Okay, so just going to read from the charter. Deadlines for submission of referenda, which should be referenda, will be a date that coincides with the deadlines of the election materials for the fall and for the spring. All deadlines will be advertised through the SA monthly newsletters as well as the other usual publicity instruments. Once a referendum question with the appropriate number of signatures has been submitted, the SA general body, which is us, will roll call vote by simple majority whether to hold the referendum. The vote will also make the provision for two collective community votes. If the SA votes by a margin of 80% or more of voting members to not hold the referendum is suspended. If the SA votes by simple majority of less than 80% of the vote to not hold the referendum, the submitter may overturn the decision of the SA by collecting the signatures of at least 10% of the registered undergraduate student body using the same method described in Section A. Once the referendum is approved or has gathered the support of at least 10% of the registered undergraduate student body, the following timeline will be observed, which you can look at your charters later. Now, vote 32 and 35, which we're discussing today, got the 400 or so signatures that allowed them to go onto the ballot with SA approval. They haven't gotten 10% of the student body, so they can't get go on the ballot without SA approval. So if you vote by more than 80%, you can stop either of these now. If you vote between 50% and 80%, then they can still override you by getting more signatures. One at a time. Well, separate votes for each.
Yeah, we'll do each separately. We have the sponsor of each referendum here. I'm going to give you each a minute separately for 32 and then 35 to just quickly introduce it and if you're, like, if there's any background information you can
give.
Can I request that we discuss 35 first, only because we have a member of the community here with us and Matt has to be here anyway.
Second.
All right. So if there's no dissent of starting with 35, whenever you're ready, take a minute to explain.
So referendum number 35 is asking the question, should American sign language satisfy the foreign language requirement at Cornell? Currently, it does not satisfy the language requirement, so if students are coming in with transfer credit, it can't even fulfill it. As you may know, we also do not have a class. Different approach that we're working on, but if a student has American Sign Language experience, they clearly may have much difficulty learning another language, so it would benefit the community tremendously if they could have that credit count.
Great, so we're going to open up the floor for questions, but I wanted to check because there were four hands up generally about referendum. I had Richard, Sarah, Gabe, and Wei Hong. Raise your hand if you want to be on the speaker's list for 35 also.
I just told you, which is enough.
Oh, I have you guys for that too. Sorry. And then Wei Hong. And Gabe, did you want for this one? Okay, so we'll come back to you. Great. All right, first we have David.
Is it me?
Yes.
Hi, how are you? My only question that I would like to pose to you is really just an exercise in how you guys are going to prepare to respond to what happens to the fact that because they contain more American sign language, that foreign languages in general try and incorporate another culture, another type of life that tries to include more languages that would become more exposed to their technical encounters. How would American language satisfy that?
So deaf culture is its own culture in and of itself. There's a very strong community. They would call themselves big D deaf. So if someone is deaf, as in they cannot hear you, they're little D deaf. They're deaf, they identify as deaf, big D deaf. So they have their own community. It's a completely different culture. You could learn the culture aspect of that. So this definitely fulfills the foreign language as teaching a new culture, immersing in a different type of environment in the same way.
Next we have Adam.
Yeah, this is for Daniel. Can I
you can stop this question.
Yeah, no, so this is timeline for implementation because 31 is the
So it's a certain number of signatures they have to reach to then be, I think it was 450, and then it comes to us. So because these have 450, but fewer than 10% of the student body, they can now get onto the ballot with our approval.
With 31 passed, though, like, it's yet to be implemented.
31 will be implemented within the next 6 days.
document the effect of them, or because they're going to be on the sprint data.
Right. Can I respond to the question because I think I understand Adam's question? So basically, what happened after 31 class is that we've been having meetings with administrators to figure out how to implement it, and we're working right now on making a trial and figuring out how much money it will actually cost. Because what this is saying is this is giving student opinion on the topic, and you guys can feel free to chime in. Like, you guys have been doing work on this before, so if you want to say what groundwork you've already been working on.
If I may add also one more thing, there is no guarantee for effect from the referendum. In many ways, it's really just a poll of student opinion. It's just like passing a sense of the body resolution through the essay, but you actually get a large amount of students who click the yes button and show they're behind it, rather than just the essay members and whoever else is in the room. But it is in no way has the administration signed a contract saying they're going to go through with it before we create it. So it's really just a poll. It's not a binding agreement with the administration.
Okay, I asked. So we actually have been working with the College of Arts and Sciences and working with their administration, and they're proposing that ASL is included to account for the foreign language requirement, but they're actually looking for the student support to meet adversity from faculty who may think it should not, even though other faculty think it should. So if the student body supports this referendum, then it would help the administration to get it through more smoothly, even though they've already begun the conversation.
Thank you. Next, we have Richard.
Hey, so I'm a full support resolution. I just have a question about how ASL plays into the other reports for Asian language taught in Cornell that don't count. For example, I took a PhD class in Acadian or Acadia form, and I was told afterwards it wouldn't count for foreign language requirement because it doesn't have, it strictly, is, a language that, is very small. It doesn't have a class that Cornell satisfied, I guess, a full, major load, which is why it wouldn't count it as foreign language. So I'm curious, if this is implemented, how many ASL classes would you expect at Cornell, and how many semesters of ASL could a student who wants to learn ASL and does not know already would be able to take?
So this question is actually not directed at the fact that there is an ASL class, so we're trying to just get the credits to count. So having a class in and of itself would be a separate question, which we are also trying to address. But as I know, I think they are trying also to get the ancient languages satisfied requirement.
No, this is no chance.
That's not what they told me.
Matt, do you have something to add?
No,
I thought you were
going to. No.
All right.
Going to Julia.
You're on.
I yield to Julia.
Yeah. Well, to your question, Richard, I think, American Sign Language had a huge program at my high school, and I think because it is a very predominantly used language in the United States, it merits having a major and working toward and at least working toward that end. So I think that's kind of the goal of a referendum, right? Trying to understand American Sign Language as a legitimate linguistic form that merits having a full course load because of the element of also cultural study that is with it. I can see a major in American Sign Language, similar to that which you have with Spanish or French.
Thanks, Leah. Next is Bird.
So I'm also a full support of the resolution. My only questions were regarding you were saying that there is no current class at Cornell for it. Have you done any studies in regards to how many students would be interested in participating in such a class?
Yes, we have. We actually have a proposal that we have written out. It's in front of Glad that we did a lot of surveys of how many students would want to, but the overwhelming majority of students that we spoke to would love to take the class, and even more would love to take it if it counted for foreign language requirement.
Point of information. Just for clarity, is there currently an American Sign Language course program, or what is the current state of American Sign Language?
So, point of information is to the chair, you're two people away on the speakers list. Next we have Wei Hong.
Do you only have a language requirement in arts and science?
No other college has foreign language requirement, correct? AAP has a foreign language requirement? So AAP and arts. All right, guys, decorum. Wei Hong.
What's the most important of this referendum, and make a note
didn't answer my question.
Okay, but there was a motion.
So can we vote?
All right. All those in favor of closing discussion? Okay. Either have your placard up or don't have it up. All those opposed? All those who abstain? Sorry guys, it's 60%. Yes. Discussion is closed, and now we're now going to vote on whether or not the referendum will appear on the ballot. Peter is going to do, as per our charter, we have to do it by roll call. But first, there's two votes allocated to community members. So all non-voting undergraduate members of the Cornell community are allowed to vote. So if you're in favor of putting this referendum on the ballot, please raise your hand. All those opposed? All those abstain? By a vote of 11-1-0, we will be adding two community votes in the affirmative. So now, Peter, whenever you're ready. I'm abstaining for now.
Because I
people who also might be disadvantaged in easier classes and harder classes, because if they get a B in an A class, their GPA is still higher than if they get a B minus in a C plus or C class, but they still beat them better than a lot of their peers who came from advantaged backgrounds. You're heavily disadvantaging those students at the expense of people who, for example, are taking really easy classes and not doing well in them. So it's not necessarily an equity issue, because people from different lived experiences are taking classes at various different colleges and different majors, and some people take easy classes, some people take hard classes.
Thank you, Richard. Can I do two? We have a really long one.
Sorry, I didn't know you wanted to mention that. Is there a way to guarantee that
All those opposed? All those abstain? All right. By a vote of 7-15-0, this discussion is staying open. Next on the speakers list is actually, have you had a chance to respond?
Well, they kind of responded as well. Take the question.
Wait on.
Oh, yeah, please.
Wait, what was your question?
Oh, like, are you engaging? Are you
oh, okay. Oh, yeah. So, this is obviously trying to engage the poll of the student body to see whether or not, like, they want them or not. But, like, you can't guarantee any actions because of another question that was addressed yet. But we can't guarantee anything ever on any resolution. So it would be kind of ridiculous to hold that policy, except for the student activity and our bylaws.
I just want that corrected.
You can have 10 seconds.
The Faculty Senate Educational Policy Committee could very easily say, we are going to change the transcript notation policy, or the transcript policy, based on the results of the referendum. They have that power. They just aren't going to do it because the referendum doesn't matter. Thank you.
All right, Myra.
So, this way, like, I get it, and I get that a lot of people think that, or a lot of people who, okay, I'm not going to say that. So I've been in that position as someone in ILR who has wanted to venture out of my college. I took multivariable calculus my first semester here as a freshman, and I did better in that course than I did in a large econ lecture. So I get, like, that argument and the need for median grades on your transcript. However, as someone who comes from a disadvantaged background, I went to a huge public school, grew up very low-income working class community, and I realized that a lot of people, especially first-generation students and low-income students who have gone to, like, large public schools and haven't had, you know, that preparation that most of the Cornell student body does have, the fact that we come in and we're expected to be similar, like, I think it's unreasonable, and, like, we graduate at statistically lower rates, and a lot of the time it's because that we feel like an inadequacy in academics, in seeing our transcript and seeing that we did below the median, but we still think that we did well. I think that's detrimental to our emotional well-being and when we apply to jobs, and just personally, like, as a first gen student, like, it's
most of the stuff,
like, to see that.
Alex?
Thank you. Alright, so first to address the point on referendums at large, I think the referendums are an important tool to gauge the sense of the body, in that case, the student, and I don't think it's the worst thing in the world if it may ease up to some degree some type of polling on an issue. With that, in regards to median course grade on transcript, I don't particularly have a strong opinion, but I will say that Cornell is by far way too competitive. There's way too much competition among students, and median grades aren't helping this, and the fact that we're competing with our peers is healthy to some degree, but it also causes a lot of stress and a lot of mental health concerns to our community that should be in mind when you're thinking about this issue. Again, I don't have a very strong opinion on this, but I think it's something we should be considering, and we should be allowing
Can I do one more? Yeah.
I think that there's disadvantages and advantages to both. I think it would be good to hear what the people have to say from the entire school. I think that because of how difficult Cornell is, and because there could be classes here that the median grade is lower than at other schools, from my angle, I think that having the median grade there would advantage you, because then if your grade is in an equivalent class to someone who's up to Harvard and they got an A plus, but you got a B plus, they would know why you got that B plus. So I think there are advantages and disadvantages, which I think bring this to the community to vote on will be a great idea.
Alright.
So that kind of answered part of what I wanted to say, but I wanted to say that we should stop, like, not that everyone's doing this, but some people are debating their stances, like, some of the yes and the no stances. What we're doing right now is just
So I think there's more discussion.
All those in favor of closing discussion?
Thank you.
want to create a polling system, we should create a polling system. Because that's create, like, your goal is, through a polling system, your goal should be to get a census body. And, like, we can't be advertising this as a resolution. In addition, there's so much discussion around this subject that we are having in an intimate, like location. And it's good to have everyone else discussing this because they, like, if you're on a resolution, or if you're doing your votes, right, you see this and you go, yes, just check me, right? You don't think about it. You don't put the time and effort into actually understanding the implications of what you're doing. And that's something that we're doing right now, right here. And if you do feel strongly about this, you should be able to come to this, like, platform and voice your opinion through the community, right? Talk to your representatives. This is more a resolution type issue than something that can be discussed through the platform that we're trying to do right now.
Thank you. No.
Agriculture?
No.
Media large?
No.
Literature?
No.
Blue?
Yes.
McDermott?
Absent.
Aguilar?
No.
McBride?
Yes.
Montejo?
Yes.
Musto?
Not yet.
Rifle?
No.
Refuge?
Yeah.
Wrong?
Yes.
Hewitt?
Yes.
Valdez?
Yes.
Does Monocon?
No.
And one?
No.
Sounds like a no.
9, 12, 1.
Alright, so, and then we add the 2 no votes in the community, and this will not be going on the ballot. Wait. Wait, 1 second.
This will not be going on the ballot unless it collects more than 10% of the student body signatures. Yes. It is still eligible to get on the ballot through signatures.
Alright. And
what is that number?
15.
Does that include
graduate students? No, it's only undergrad, so 14,000 something. 1,250 is the number.
Alright. First I'm gonna entertain the point of information. For what? For what, sorry. Okay, I'm going to entertain their announcement if there's no dissent, and then I'll entertain Diana's notes.
So next week, March 15th, the freshman rest, along with a few other people, are hosting a blood drive in our PCC. We have advertising materials for it. We seem like we're setting that up, so just inform the constituents, please.
Possibly it's going to be necessary our PCC.
All right. Diana had a motion to adjourn.
Sorry,
is there any dissent?
Yes, a dissent. I have one announcement. I was at some meeting this week.
Okay.
I was talking about the clock tower lighting policy. So if anybody has like some sort of deal that they want the clock tower lit, I would
seeing no other dissent, we're going to adjourn.
Yeah.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.